This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Discussing the book Bullshit Jobs by David Graeber. Barry, a guy, great having you back on the show.
Yeah, as always, it's great to be back on the program. It's been too long.
Yeah, and we met up the last time I was in SF.
Oh, yeah, we had a bit of a little adventure in a more colorful part of the city, but I think it was worth it in the end.
Oh, yeah, I think we ended up, where did we go? We went to...
Tenderloin.
Yeah, the Tenderloin, then we ended up at the gelato place in North Beach.
That's correct.
Yeah, it's been a while since we've done a show, so since, in case the audience is new to your ideas or they haven't listened to previous shows, can you give a brief introduction of yourself and have your views evolved or changed since the last time we've talked?
All right, so... I used to blog at a place called Occident Invicta, a now defunct site, with a co-blogger named Dota. I also used to have guest articles uploaded on Alternative Right, so kind of started out in that whole scene, but ever
and
since then
not
I started...
the Richard Spencer one, the Andy Nowicki, Colin Liddell, right?
Yeah, the Andy Nowicki, Colin Liddell one, not the Richard Spencer one. And yeah, ever since then I've been starting to move... progressively more to the left. Rest assured, I haven't become a social justice warrior. You don't have to fear on that count, but I have moved to the left on economics, and I've become a lot more interested in left-wing economic ideas as of late. Well, because I do live in the Bay Area, and things are expensive here, so economics are certainly a big priority for me.
And yeah, we've done countless shows on the housing crisis, but that is all relevant to the whole concept of bullshit jobs.
Yeah, I'd say bullshit jobs is definitely in its own category, but, well, in some ways you could say it's indirectly related because Graeber does talk a lot about the role of finance in creating all of these bullshit jobs, and as I've mentioned before, finance certainly plays a heavy role in inflating housing prices, so all the BS is somehow connected.
And that was going back to the show we did on the fire economy, which that must have been at least a year ago, maybe more. This article was posted on Matthew Pegasus' website, Alt of Center.
Yes. The bullshit jobs one. Yes. I don't know about the fire economy. That was
the new one, bullshit jobs. What are your thoughts on that website and the general concept?
Well, it seems like it has a lot of good material, and you know. People want to commission me to write another article, I'd be more than happy to do so.
So let's start off with David Graeber's background. So he's an anthropologist, and he has a background as an anarcho-communist?
Correct. And what's interesting is that, at least according to him, he was more or less blacklisted by U.S. academia, which is... why he was obliged to move to the UK and teach at different universities there. And he was part of the anti-globalization protests in the late 90s, and he's also credited with coining the whole concept of the 99%, as in, we're the 99% versus the 1%. And, yeah, he's been involved in anarchist activism for quite some time.
Yeah, and I've noticed since, well, some of that has gotten absorbed into the Bernie Sanders movement, but the whole concept, the Occupy Wall Street 99% movement has kind of been pushed aside in favor of more the gender and racial identity politics of the left?
I'd agree, more or less, but I do think that's starting to change. And, you know, even though people said Occupy Wall Street was ultimately a failure, I mean, it did culminate in Bernie Sanders' candidacy. And now you have people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez coming out and say that in a moral society, billionaires wouldn't exist. And in places like, you have now writers like Anand Giridharadas in his book Winners Take All, denouncing the whole elite-driven change in philanthropy. And so I do think the conversation has changed. And while the social justice warriors are as rabid as ever, I do think that economics is becoming more of a focus for the left, for the better.
And with Ocasio-Cortez, she's kind of a, yeah, she's a fusion of both of them, the SJW politics and the economic, with some economic leftism, but that's basically what you're, that's basically what you're going to get. You're not going to get, like, some kind of politics that I guess would be described as a pejorative sense as, like, the Bernie bros. But just going back to you, so a lot of people on the dissident right are pretty disappointed with Trump. And it's important to point out you were one of the few people in that, from that, who came out of that scene who basically rejected Trump from the beginning and backed Bernie Sanders.
Right, and to me it was common sense because Trump's a billionaire, and as one person said it best, I forget who, but you know, these people, they don't want to rock the boat because it's their boat, and if you're a billionaire, you're not really gonna be a revolutionary. So yeah, I always suspected Trump would just do the typical enrich rip his fellow plutocrats schemes, and I didn't really expect him to do much for regular working people.
So with bullshit jobs, it kind of goes back to the concept of managerialism. There's that book, The Managerial Revolution. I'm not sure if you've reviewed it, but you've discussed that general topic. So basically what managerialism is an economy, an economic system based on bureaucracy and basically managing the economy, managing the society, rather than actual innovation.
And I remember you you had a show where you interviewed Matt Forney, who reviewed The Managerial Revolution by James Burnham. And so, yeah, I guess you could say that bullshit jobs is the culmination of the managerial revolution. And yeah, so, well, to use Graeber's exact words, he describes our current system as managerial feudalism, because, well, this is really at the heart of bullshit jobs, because you think that in a hyper-competitive capitalist economy where firms have to be lean and mean, always maximizing productivity, always increasing profits, that there's no way that they would possibly waste money on useless workers. And both libertarians and Marxists tend to believe this. Of course, libertarians think that anything that's paid for is voluntary and productive in a free market. And meanwhile, people like Richard Wolff on the far left argue that, well, if an employer pays you $20 an hour, that means you're producing more than $20 an hour for them, and they're taking your surplus value that you produce. But bullshit jobs kind of complicates this narrative, because obviously there are a lot of deadweight employees who do absolutely nothing, and in fact in many cases detract from the company, subtract value, and yet they often enjoy these lucrative sinecures. And so what we really have is a system of feudalism where, you know, you don't really make money so much based on producing, but just extracting via, you know, rent, interest, fees, penalties. And then, of course, you have to distribute that loot to underlings in order to maintain the system. Because, you know, a feudal lord wouldn't just extract wealth from commoners and keep it all for himself. He'd have to use it to get himself some knights and vassals, retainers, and so on. And so I feel like our corporations today really resemble the old feudal system.
The thing is, you hear economic conservatives talking about how there's all these useless, incompetent, lazy employees, and they'll bash the unions. But the thing is that the corporations, it's important to point out, they don't necessarily select for the employees who are the most creative or innovative. They sort of depend upon this large bureaucratic class. So that basically the quality of the employees reflects the values of the corporations, but you get all that nonsense from the kind of like the Reaganomics mentality of conservatives.
Right, and one point Graeber really likes to emphasize is that conservatives love to pretend that the only wasteful employees are public sector, bureaucratic, government-based employees, but they also abound in the private sector, and you've got all kinds of, you know, flunkies. Well, I guess we can define the terms later, but all kinds of paper pushers and other people who don't really do anything. And yeah, the whole point is about having a bunch of underlings who absorb your values and who are loyal to the system. It's not really about productivity so much as loyalty and power. And
yeah, I remember one time when I applied for a job, I had to fill out this philosophical question, and they basically asked questions like, do you believe that hard work will lead to wealth and stuff like that?
Oh, yeah. I'm going to presume you answered yes.
Of course I did, question. Yeah.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah, they want to make sure you're a good old Protestant work ethic bootstrapper. As I pointed out in the article, one thing that blew my mind when reading the book is learning just how recent, from a world history standpoint anyway, this whole work is good attitude is.
Because in a lot of ancient societies, there was this concept of a leisure class, and a lot of the philosophers and scientists of the past, including the Renaissance era, they had people who supported them financially or bring them food. So you really need, for innovation, you do need some degree of a leisure class.
Right, and one point Graeber makes is that one of the reasons why we don't have innovation, going back to that point, is because everyone is made to work. And he points out that in Britain around the 60s and 70s, you'd have a great band every decade or so. And he points out that some of the great musicians in the Beatles were on the dole, i.e. welfare. And in fact, they would refer to the dole as the rock and roll. And so you get great bands, and then also traditionally a lot of scientists would be given resources and autonomy, and then boom, randomly things would get invented and there would be breakthroughs.
Also, we have to change the way we look at welfare, because there are legitimate problems with welfare as far as building up a large underclass, but at the same time we have to get away from that mentality that basically you're judged whether you're basically where you call people a moocher, because reality is like we can get to the basic income, but you need some kind of a financial support for innovation.
Right, and you know, when you just let people do their innovation, it happened. But now, if you want to say be a scientist and receive money, you have to apply for a grant and you have to document ahead of time what it is you're going to do. And of course, that kind of documentation and that rigid planning isn't really conducive to innovation. So, and as to once again quote Graeber, one of the problems, again going back to welfare, is that, well, you know, the people who might have formed a great band back in the 60s, well, they would be obliged to, you know, lift boxes at a warehouse in order to qualify for their benefits. I just think that the system we have now is utterly fatuous, because, you know, a lot of conservatives will attack welfare spending and general entitlement spending on the ground that it costs too much and it blows up the deficit. But in reality, a lot of people who receive benefits are all means tested and they have to find work. And you now have more and more states imposing work requirements, for example, on Medicaid recipients. And so, yeah, guess what? You have to spend money to have people to monitor these benefits recipients. So it's really not about money. It's more, as Graeber has always said, our current system is held together by because of political and moral reasons, not so much any economic imperatives.
The political reasons of the establishment wanting to stay in power, I mean, that's pretty obvious, but can you explain what you mean by the moral imperatives of maintaining the system? And this actually is kind of relative. We did a whole show on, like, the secular slave morality, but what do you mean by that?
Well, I do think that the moral imperatives definitely serve the political imperatives, because as Graeber pointed out, in this country and in many other countries, the whole labor theory of value used to be a given. As recently as Abraham Lincoln, and the idea was that, you know, value comes from work, from production, and, you know, you have to make stuff. You're not supposed to just extract it. And Michael Hudson, of course, in his various works, goes into the difference between healthy industrial profits and economic rents. And, you know, Hudson's point of view was very much mainstream for much of the 19th century and for during the early days of capitalism. But then, of course, what happened is you have, you know, mass production, economies of scale, the return of rentiers, and now fewer and fewer jobs are productive and fewer can be justified based on what they add to society. So instead, you have this idea that, well, work is good in and of itself. In fact, it's good precisely because it's often pointless and because you're suffering inside. You know, no pain, no gain. It's about building character now.
So you referenced the 90s comedy Office Space, and the film itself is not so much about the economic angle, but it's more a parody of the corporate culture. And the main character, Peter, is depressed, and basically it goes into the kind of dehumanizing nature of that environment.
Right, and that's another reason why I like Graeber's work so much, because as much as I respect him, one of the problems I have with people like Dean Baker and other left-wing economists is that they're obsessed with jobs. And just like their right-wing counterparts, they think jobs are good. Yeah, so Dean Baker, he's always going on about full employment and as if just having a job is a virtue in and of itself. But what people like Graeber do is they actually step back and take a look at what these jobs entail and whether they're actually good people. And he points out that it's not so much that jobs are good, it's just that not having a job and not having a money is bad. But clearly, as a species, really, we should have better choices, having a terrible job or being unemployed and broke.
The thing is we do have the economic means to support people financially and like a basic income to take care of their basic needs, such as food, shelter, and healthcare. But the thing is that people will still feel a need to succeed in their career for social status, as well as to have access to positional goods. So I'm not sure if you're familiar with the concept of positional goods, but basically a good example of that would be something like real estate.
Right. Well, I mean, of course, status is definitely a key, but I think it's also because people want to feel useful, and that's something Graeber emphasizes in the book. But as an article, we're sort of taught to believe that we can only feel useful if we have a job. And it's actually pretty depressing, because in conversations with, you know, friends and coworkers, I brought up a UBI, and they, almost all of them, said, well, you know, what are we going to do with our lives then? And it's kind of a self-own, really. They're basically saying that, well, our lives are so uninteresting that we wouldn't possibly know what to do with our time if we didn't have a job. So, as Graeber again points out, it really betrays a lack of imagination in our culture.
You reference this German psychologist, Karl Grus, and he basically came up with this theory that people will perform certain actions if it brings them pleasure or brings them rewards.
Well, not even necessarily rewards, but just the satisfaction that what you're doing has an effect on your surrounding environments.
So by that, do you mean personal selfish well-being or altruism or a combination of both?
I think a combination of both. It's just sort of the subconscious belief that your actions make a difference and therefore matter. And one thing Graeber does is he, I couldn't pinpoint it and quote it in the article, but on occasion he has quoted Dostoevsky, who basically said that if you really want to break a man's spirit, force him to do something that he knows is utterly pointless, like moving a boulder from one side of the road to another and then back again. And sure enough, apparently in Soviet gulags, they would punish people in this manner. And the reason why it drove them crazy is because they know that their actions have no effect on the world and that they're doing something pointless just for its own sake. And that's what makes bullshit jobs and other forms of compulsory pointless activity so dehumanizing.
And you point out that a lot of red state conservatives, the reason they support the military, it's because one of the few jobs where it requires a very limited number of credentials, but there's also a sense that it's rewarding, a sense of accomplishment, that you're basically contributing something to your country.
Right, and, you know, if you want to travel around the world and stuff without having a master's degree or at least a four-year degree, join the military, because as Graeber pointed out, if you want to join the Peace Corps, you need a degree. And so, yeah, if you're stuck in middle America without many prospects and you're never going to be an art critic for the New York Times or a film critic for the Los Angeles Times, well, the military's your next best bet.
Does Graeber present any alternatives of how our economy should be structured?
Well, he definitely thinks that it should be based on our needs and that caring labor should be rewarded, that people who actually help others should be well compensated. So teachers, nurses, social workers, and so on. And as he points out, we kind of have there's sort of an inverse relationship between how much your work benefits others and how much you get paid for it. So if you're a social worker and you want to help others, well, you'll get paid peanuts. And meanwhile, bankers who contribute very little to society, and in fact, we'd be better off without most of them, they enjoy lucrative salaries. So that, at the very least, we should correct that imbalance.
So that's the thing about a socialism is, I don't see an egalitarian version of socialism where everyone gets paid the same. That's not going to work because there won't be the incentive. So incentives are relevant to a degree. But the thing is, if we're going to have socialism, then we should take into account like what each job, how much it's contributing to society.
Right. And in fairness to socialists, I don't think they actually believe that everyone should be paid. I think they believe that everyone should more or less have their basic needs secured, so housing, healthcare, and food, and so on. But
so with that argument, you would say it's more, have you heard any socialists advocate everyone gets paid the same, or it's more something that conservatives say to bash socialists?
No, because I read Jacobin, I read Current Affairs, and I read what socialists like Bhaskar Sankara say in debates, and yeah, they're not saying everyone has exactly the same amounts of income, and in fact he justifies people like LeBron James, you know, and other superstar athletes getting paid well. It's just that everyone has their basic needs tended to, and that wealth is not extractive, i.e. based on rent. So, you know, landlords, predatory financiers, monopolists, and so on, they've got to go.
This is more in line with real estate and the FIRE economy, but I'm not sure if we touched on this. So as far as the rent-based economy, so how would things work? So ideally, so with a rent, when you're renting an apartment, a large portion of your income is going to the landlord, but at the same time, it's not feasible for everyone to own their own home just because of the way just because of the limited amount of land and the urban layout. So would the only economy be condominiums, or does that have issues as well?
Well, you know, it's actually interesting because recently I read that for every homeless person, there are six or so vacant homes. And so one thing that people like Michael Hudson and others with socialist leanings would do is abolish absentee land ownership. And, you know, the whole idea of everyone owning their own property is actually not that radical. In fact, the British Catholic conservative G.K. Chesterton was a distributionist, and he wasn't against private property, but he believed that it should be more widely distributed so everyone has their own property and therefore enjoys autonomy.
So you would say that you're closer to distributism than Marxism?
Correct, yes. I think that if everyone had their own private property and their own means of production, a lot of the ills of both capitalism and big government could be remedied.
As far as innovation goes, like, we're really not seeing that much innovation now. So things like, I think we were discussing in our talk we had in San Francisco before we planned out this show, things like, just say like underwater cities or innovation and alternative energy, like, we're really not seeing that much of that. And the other thing is in the tech industry, so as far as tech jobs go, like, there was this period, primarily in the 90s, where we actually were seeing a lot of innovation in tech. But basically most of the jobs in tech, it's more about managing the current tech apparatus rather than actual innovation.
Right. It's just about managing the system. And I even remember playing Grand Theft Auto 5 and seeing an advertisement for their equivalent of the iPhone, you know, 3% longer battery, 3% thinner, 500% more expensive, sort of mocking how Silicon Valley doesn't really produce anything new. It just, you know, repackages old things and just sort of maintains its platforms. And also, yeah, we're really not innovative because just recently, California's governor, Gavin Newsom, said, nope, can't do a high-speed rail. And it's absurd, you know. In the wealthiest state, in the wealthiest country, you know, the heartland where innovation supposedly booms, nope, can't do a high-speed rail, even though they have that in other countries.
Do you support Elon Musk's idea of the Hyperloop, or are you skeptical of that?
Well, I'm skeptical of Elon Musk and, you know, these tech oligarchs in general, and I think he might want to his own backyard before trying to change the world. But, well, I have talked with Dota a lot about this, and, you know, we do concur that eventually, if humanity is to survive, we need to consider space exploration, sort of create a new frontier, especially since the frontier is a major part of the American ethos.
As far as innovation goes, does Graeber propose any explicit policies that would encourage that kind of innovation, and what are your thoughts?
So, as I pointed out in the article, Graeber's not really a policy wonk, and for that matter, neither am I. But he does propose a universal basic income, and his attitude is that, yeah, look, it would require more taxes, and if we did do that, we'd have to be subjected to a bunch of lame poetry and terrible blogs and deranged YouTube rants and a whole bunch of nonsense. But as he points out, if even just a few UBI recipients become the next Einstein or the next Beatles or some other great artist or scientist, then it'll be worth it. And really, you just give people enough to live on and you let them pursue their passions, and yeah, a lot of people will be restless, a lot of people won't amount to much, but I believe that enough people would that it would pay for itself.
And another thing about automation and the basic income is automation will basically, in the long term at least, it will kind of separate between which jobs are managerial and can be easily automated and which jobs are genuinely innovative, because the innovation, that's something that pretty much impossible to automate. But a lot of these managerial jobs will be automated, so it will take away basically their importance in society.
Well, I don't know about that, actually, because one thing Graeber likes to point out is that if you are really worried about the robots taking all the jobs, well, never underestimate modern capitalism's ability to generate more bullshit jobs. Because what's funny is that Graeber likes to quote the economist John Maynard Keynes, who in the 30s, I believe, predicted that we would be working 15 hours a week. And for all of these people who act as if, oh, a leisure society is impossible, we have to keep working, you know, for much of the 20th century, it was presumed that by now we would be, you know, working 15 hours a week and enjoying leisurely lives. But what happened is that instead of letting technology serve us and enjoy more free time, we've just created more and more bullshit jobs that people have to show up to.
And there's this whole issue we've discussed before with these H-1Bs in the tech industry. And Trump has actually called for increasing legal immigration, which pretty makes a lot of his supporters, I mean, a lot of his supporters are pretty pissed off about this, of course. But the thing about the whole issue about in regards to immigration is not so much about just taking jobs from Americans. It's also about filling up these useless managerial positions.
Well, I don't know how many managerial positions these immigrants occupy, but I definitely think that, well, in some ways it's kind of like feudalism, because these H-1B visa workers, they're kind of like serfs. I mean, well-paid serfs, relatively speaking, but serfs all the same. They have to serve their corporate master or they can't live here. So it reinforces that whole paradigm.
Are most of the people opposed to the H-1B program's immigration restrictionists, or are there have there been some progressives who are in general more pro-immigration but have criticized it on those grounds?
Well, yes, because I actually remember when writing BART, Bay Area's Rapid Transit
System. Oh, right, the Progressives for Immigration Reform. I interviewed Kevin Lynn about that.
Yeah, I saw a poster on BART basically decrying the effect of H-1B visas on tech workers. And also, not so long ago, I'd say a few months ago, there was a big storm on Twitter and social media because Angela Nagel, the Kill All Normies author, she wrote an article called The Left Case Against Open Borders, and it really divided the left. On the one hand, you had people who said, oh, this is just pandering to the right, and immigrants don't threaten native workers, we just have to organize them. Workers of the world unite. Whereas others would say, hello, supply and demand. If you saturate the labor pool, then workers will have less bargaining power. So,
and Bernie Sanders made a similar point in that Vox interview, but he backed down on that.
Yeah, he did. And yeah, like I said, it used to be common sense on the left that more workers means more, less bargaining power for workers. Because it's funny, in many other contexts, the left can see this. For example, when Silicon Valley CEOs promote more coding education in school and more STEM skills in school, the left can see right through it. They know that these Silicon Valley oligarchs are just trying to increase the supply of coders and programmers so they can drive down tech wages. In that context, supply and demand is very obvious. But for some reason, when it comes to immigration, that point just eludes them.
And you make a good point in this article. You make a parallel between conservatives condemning people for wanting free stuff like universal health care and leftists telling people to check their privilege or feeling entitled.
Right, and I notice this in my own day-to-day life. In general, there's this very American belief that, you know, how dare you feel like you deserve anything good and you just have to accept the reality for the way it is. And, you know, there's always someone worse off than you, so if you want more for yourself or expect more for yourself, well, how dare you? There's someone worse off than you and you're just being selfish. And
yeah, they sound totally indistinguishable. So a conservative would talk about all these people on welfare and saying, oh, they're lazy and entitled and they need to just work and become middle class that way. And basically, when the left are talking about it, I guess I hear SJWs critiquing the alt-right. They're like, oh, you need to get rid of your white privilege and you're not entitled to anything. But they're almost like complete parallels of each other.
Right, exactly. And there was actually one Jacobin article that argued that privilege discourse is fundamentally conservative. And you see this with SJWs a lot, for example, when addressing frustrated young white men, even those who are relatively low income, they'll say, well, you know, the fact that you can read this article on a computer right now proves that you are more privileged than the vast majority of people throughout the world. So, since there's always going to be someone who's worse off than you in some way, it's a very good way to keep people meek and unorganized.
Yeah, so it's a sort of, it is a slave morality, because basically, there's so much misery around the world and poverty. I mean, that's so much cliche. But the thing is, people's status is relevant to the people around them. So
right.
If neoliberal elites tell people, working class people in the Midwest, not to feel bad because of people in Africa, then that's going to make them more meek and not challenge the neoliberal elites.
Right, and all, like you said, it's all relative compared to the people around you. So if everyone else around you owns a car and an iPhone, the fact that you too have a car and an iPhone isn't going to be much comfort. And also, you have to look at the basic necessities of life, you know, rent, healthcare. And if you're struggling to pay for those, the fact that you can watch a YouTube video on a laptop doesn't mean you're suddenly affluent by any means.
And the key part of this book and the key point you make in the review, it's not so much just about restructuring the economy. The first step is changing people's philosophical outlook towards work, and goes back to what I said about the kind of need for a job for a status. So that, I mean, that's a big barrier to that, but I think the first step is just basically the message of the book that a lot of jobs are not necessary. Because if you think about the way economics work, the economic right will talk about how socialism consumes a lot of jobs. Because socialism or government programs consume a large portion of the economy. But these useless jobs are also consuming a large portion of the economy that could be used for better things.
Exactly. And Graeber has even described our current system as the Sovietization of capitalism, where, you know, you have a bunch of make-work jobs just like they had in the Soviet Union. And going back to changing attitudes, as Graeber said many times, the real problem is that many people are afraid of real freedom. They wouldn't know what to do with it. And so we really just have to, before we try to enact any new laws or implement any policies, we really have to just reimagine what a truly free society looks like, and that'll require a lot of work.
Is there anything else about the book that you'd like to add that I didn't touch upon?
Not especially. I actually did want to mention the way Graeber juxtaposed the whole New York sanitation strike versus the Irish baker strike, because I really think that does get to the heart of the matter, because there's just something perverse when garbage men who actually do something useful, and if you don't believe me, well, as Graeber points out, after just around 11 days or so, New York had to capitulate to the garbage men's demands because the city was uninhabitable. You know, trash was everywhere. And meanwhile, in Ireland, bankers went on strike for around 6 months, I believe. And guess what? The native Irish found ways to work around it just fine, and nobody really missed them. And yet bankers get paid a hell of a lot more than garbage men. And that to me suggests that our current political economy is fundamentally broken.
Well, we basically judge jobs based on the income level rather than what they actually contribute.
Right. And part of the problem, to go back to some of my earlier work on Michael Hudson, is that, you know, thanks to economists like John Bates Clark and other neoclassical economists, there's this notion that there's no such thing as unearned income, and that any income earned automatically reflects its productive value. So therefore, the more money you have, the more you produce. And so I think that's partially why people are so confused on this matter.
Yeah, if you look at generation of wealth and the concept of unearned income, there's wealth that's generated through innovation or creating jobs or entrepreneurship, but a lot of wealth is just generated through managerialism and the managerial food chain.
Right, and as a lot of people have pointed out, if you look at so many of the top billionaires, yeah, they weren't just heirs who inherited money from daddy, but they also didn't legitimately earn most of their income. I mean, take Bill Gates. Without monopolistic behavior and copyright protection, he'd still probably have to work for a living. Or Jeff Bezos, who underpaid his workers and enjoyed all kinds of tax breaks and tax exemptions, and various other supposedly self-made entrepreneurs.
We did talk about Trump. Do you have any thoughts on the Democratic candidates? I know a lot of people from who were Bernie Sanders supporters, and some people in our circle are supporting Tulsi Gabbard, and obviously Kamala Harris. She's basically the candidate. She's like a fusion of, she's basically the most, she's the neoliberal candidate.
Oh, yeah. No, because when you said Kamala Harris right after Tulsi Gabbard, I was pausing for a second. But yeah, they're basically trying to make her Barack Obama 2.0, but I doubt it's going to work this time because Obama was already president, so it's been done. She won't have the novelty factor going in. And also, in the aftermath of Trump's election, there was an article in the New York Times about working class black people in a Milwaukee neighborhood who didn't vote and didn't regret it. And I think a lot of blacks and other enthusiastic Obama voters during the late 2000s felt like Obama ultimately let them down. So, and also, of course, Kamala Harris has all that baggage due to her background as a prosecutor. And
she's actually more conservative on criminal justice issues. So there was that issue with, it was involving a prosecuting parents for truancy. And then when she was attorney general, there was that lawsuit about prison conditions being a cruel and unusual punishment in regards to releasing inmates. So on criminal justice issues, she's relatively conservative. And on economics, she's more of a neoliberal like Clinton. So she's only left-wing as far as like race and gender dynamics.
Right. And in fact, you know, a lot of people have problems with her because not only did she throw the book at parents of truants, but she had an opportunity to prosecute Steve Mnuchin's One West Bank. And many people in her office documented thousands of instances of misconduct, and yet she said no. So many people believe she would carry on the tradition of harsh justice for the rabble and impunity for the elites.
And she's sponsoring this bill with the Republican of Utah, Mike Lee, that would end basically country caps on immigration. So it would primarily benefit India, but it could dramatically increase legal immigration even further. So that's a bill to keep an eye on.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And you mentioned Tulsi Gabbard. I wanted to talk about her as well. And what's interesting is that many people are giving her grief because, you know, she came from a religious family in Hawaii and she said some anti-gay things in the past. And she was also apparently too chummy with Narendra Modi and Hindutva. But as many have pointed out, those aren't the real reasons behind the anti-Tulsi Gabbard animus. It's more because she repudiates our crappy bipartisan foreign policy establishment. And that's what really rattles the cages of mainstream Democrats.
So you're probably going to end up supporting her?
Well, I would prefer Bernie just because he has more of the economic focus. But if not him, then yes, I'd say Tulsi Gabbard.
We are getting close to the end of the show. Barry, a guy, do you have any upcoming articles or projects that you want to talk about?
Not off the top of my head, but you know, you were the one who recommended I write bullshit jobs, and it was one of, I think, one of the best articles I've written. And so if you have any other suggestions, I'm happy to entertain them.
Barry Guy, it's been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
Yeah, and as always, thanks for having me on. I look forward to doing this again some other time.